Hey, you, it's the takeaway for Wednesday, November 8th, 2017. Here we go.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and glad to have you with us on this Wednesday after off-year election day.
It's a good night for progressives. It's a good night for Democrats.
We've sent a message across the world.
To believe in each of us is to believe in all of us.
You've proven that we are a city of opportunity and inclusiveness.
This one's for you.
Are you ready to keep Virginia blue?
Voices from Democrats feeling good across the country last night. And that last voice you heard was Ralph Northam, Democratic candidate for the governorship of Virginia. And Keep Virginia Blue is what Ralph Northam did. And he didn't do it alone. Democrats overwhelmed Republicans in state assembly races across Virginia. They took the governor's office in New Jersey after 8 years of Chris Christie, and even in Maine, where voters there said yes to expanding Medicaid for an estimated 80,000 people. Now, in Virginia, Northam did have help from Democrats, it's true. But also, it appears, from President Donald Trump. Republican candidate Ed Gillespie used some unmistakable Trump-style tactics in Virginia, emulating a president with a 35% approval rating, and moderate voters soundly rejected it. We'll have more from New Jersey in just a moment, but let's go to Virginia first. The marquee race in this off-year election last night, a big win for Democrats, to see what the results might say and just might not say about 2018 and beyond. Michael Pope is here with Virginia Public Radio, who was on hand last night with the Democrats in Northern Virginia. Michael, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's spend just a little bit of time with the numbers. How did Ralph Northam do? Were there any surprises in the results last night?
Well, the top line number was probably the most surprising. Ralph Northam won with 54% of the vote compared to Ed Gillespie, the Republican, in the race, who got only 45% of the vote. And so that was a result that exceeded the expectations of almost everybody that was there last night at the victory party. So the Democrats really were on their game in terms of organizing and getting out the vote.
And what's behind Northam's unexpected victory here? I mean, Virginia has been increasingly blue from purple, but this was a real sweep.
It was a total sweep. You know, the governor's race was not the only statewide ticket on the ballot. There was also the lieutenant governor and the attorney general. So there were three statewide races on the ballot, and the Democrats swept all three of them. And, you know, in terms of what might account for that and what might explain that, the Democrats were really saying it was all about Trump, that Trump was looming over the election, that voters wanted to react to Trump. You know, Virginia is the only southern state that voted for Clinton and not Trump. And Gillespie is a former chairman of the Republican Party of Virginia, and he had in the past fashioned himself as a moderate, someone who wanted to go after Latino voters and bring them into the fold of the Republican Party. During this campaign, though, he transformed into like a fire-breathing conservative who defended Confederate monuments and wanted to go after sanctuary cities. And the voters in Virginia rejected that. You know, the Democrats really sort of campaigned against Trump and Trumpism. And Gillespie gave them exactly what they needed because he transformed his campaign into something that had been about tax cuts and sort of government reform into defending Confederate monuments and going after sanctuary cities.
And let's talk about that for one moment. Here is Northam during his victory rally last night.
It is that diverse society that makes this country great. And as long as I'm governor, I will make sure that we're inclusive, that we welcome people to the Commonwealth of Virginia. Our lights will be on. Our doors will be open.
Ralph Northam there talking about inclusiveness, largely as a reaction, Michael Pope. Look, let's talk about Ed Gillespie. You mentioned it. He wound up running a campaign following Donald Trump's playbook here in Virginia, vilifying and ridiculing his opponent, using racial levers and resentments as a wedge, Confederate monuments, Southern heritage. It was notable, especially because of what you said. Gillespie was a former head of the Republican National Committee, Mr. Moderate, the guy who a few short years ago said the GOP has to reach out to Latinos, a broader range of voters. Gillespie did not do that, and it says something important about Republicans right now.
Well, Gillespie found himself in kind of a spot during the primary campaign when he sort of made the beginning part of this transformation. His opponent in that primary was someone from the Trump wing of the Republican Party. In fact, he had been the chairman of the Trump campaign in Virginia. His name is Corey Stewart, and he has the same sort of issue set as Trump, defending Confederate monuments, going after undocumented immigrants. And so during the primary campaign, you know, Gillespie had to confront Trumpism, and he squeaked out a very narrow victory. It was unexpectedly narrow. And then he had to walk a tightrope, right? So he had to make sure that he was still appealing to the voters of Corey Stewart, who, you know, he needed their votes, while also sort of pulling in the moderate wing of the Republican Party, you know, in Virginia, which would be the country club, you know, horse country Republican. And he clearly was not able to do that. If you look at the swing counties in Virginia where they could go, you know, either way, Virginia Beach, Loudoun County, Henrico County, Prince William County, Northam took all of those swing counties.
Meanwhile, Michael, a shocker in Richmond, the state assembly, Democrats swarmed. They picked up 14 seats. This is not just about the governor's race. People watching from the outside aren't going to avoid the conclusion that Republicans are weak in a swing state right now. What does that say?
Well, the House Democratic leader in the House of Delegates named David Toscano, when he was speaking last night at the Northam Victory Party, he said, you know, what happened in the election is not just a wave, it's a tsunami. So this guy could potentially become the next Speaker of the House. The Democrats picked up at least 14 seats. There might actually be more, you know, after a long period of total domination by Republicans in the House of Delegates.
And Michael, a little bit of history that we need to talk about. In Northern Virginia, Danica Rome becomes the first transgender state legislator. She beat an incumbent who sponsored anti-trans bills, including a bathroom bill. This is a first, and it's a first in Virginia.
To every person who's ever been singled out, who's ever been stigmatized, who's ever been the misfit, who's ever been the kid in the corner, who's ever needed someone to stand up for them when they didn't have a voice of their own, because there's no one else who is with them. This one's for you.
So the name Danica Rome is one that your listeners should remember because they're going to be hearing a lot more of it. This was the transgender woman who beat out longtime Republican Bob Marshall, who had represented his district in Northern Virginia for many years. And this was an arch conservative, the guy who wrote the bathroom bill that would prevent transgender people from using the restroom of their choice. So it's not just that the transgender candidate won, it's who she beat, the chief enemy of the transgender community. So Danica Rome will go to Richmond representing a part of Northern Virginia that had for many years been represented by the other side.
Big victories for Democrats all across Virginia, from the state assembly seats in Richmond to the governor's office, the lieutenant governor, and on down the line. Michael Pope, thanks for coming back.
Thank you.
Michael Pope is a reporter at Virginia Public Radio.
This is one of the first major elections since Donald Trump was elected. Tonight, New Jersey sent an unmistakable message to the entire nation. We are better than this.
And now let's go to the only other governor's race in the nation yesterday. Democrat Phil Murphy beat Republican Lieutenant Governor Kim Godano in the race in New Jersey for governor, a 13-point margin for Murphy. But as Nancy Solomon says, there's plenty to learn from the contest as well as from smaller races across the state. Nancy's managing editor for New Jersey Public Radio and WNYC. Nancy, always great to have you here.
Hi, Todd.
So the governor's race, Murphy wins, the Democrat. Maybe not a shocker, but you're seeing lots of messages in this race and races across the state.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we were expecting possibly historic levels of low turnout, and that didn't happen. And I think what we saw was a really energized Democratic base that came out despite the fact that Murphy had been leading in the polls by double digits since the primary. And also, yeah, there was a certain lack of enthusiasm for this particular candidate among Democrats, not among all, but among a broad swath of them. So I think you can't see it as anything but a reaction to both wanting to make a statement and take action against Chris Christie and Donald Trump.
Donald Trump, as people watch this race from outside New Jersey, it's inevitable there's going to be a Trump interpretation here. We talked about Trump-style tactics in Virginia with Ed Gillespie. Was that a factor in New Jersey with Kim Godano?
Yeah, somewhat. She started out the race as a moderate Republican, which also Chris Christie did early in his political career. And then it wasn't working for her. So she shifted. And instead of running to the right in the primary and back to the center for the general, she flipped that. And she was more of a centrist during the primary. And she made a hard right turn sometime, I'd say, in late September. And one of the things she did was put out an ad that made it look like Phil Murphy wanted to give sanctuary to immigrants who commit crimes. It took his words out of context, and it was a very Willie Horton-esque kind of an ad for folks who are old enough to remember that. And we were hearing that could actually be a strategy that might help her. I would talk to people who were going door to door working on local races, and they said they were surprised by how many Democrats were asking them questions about what is this thing about Phil Murphy creating a sanctuary state. So there was some concern that that was going to have an effect. But it didn't play out that way.
So in local races, state races going forward, look, in this first election of the Trump era, what's the message that campaign planners, operative strategists, people who are going to run the next campaigns might be taking from what they saw in New Jersey?
Well, Phil Murphy, you know, he didn't just run a Democratic campaign. He ran a very liberal, progressive campaign, and he won. And I think, you know, the lesson after 2016, I mean, a lot of people were thinking, hey, if Bernie had been the candidate, maybe he might have won the election. So I think Democrats are going to be emboldened now to really take back some of their progressive ideas and principles.
Nancy Solomon, managing editor, New Jersey Public Radio and WNYC. Thanks again, Nancy.
Thanks, Todd.
Well, we have a bit of a recap for you. Some other notable election day results from across the country. Maine residents expanded Medicaid in a vote of confidence for Obamacare. Overall, incumbent mayors across the country did pretty well. Boston, New York, Detroit all reelected their mayors. But it was also a day of firsts. We mentioned Danica Rome in Virginia, the first transgender person to be elected to a state legislature, also a singer in a metal band called Cab Ride Home, if you didn't know that fun fact. Charlotte, North Carolina will have its first black woman as mayor. And Hoboken, New Jersey elected the state's first Sikh mayor there. Today also marks the anniversary of the 2016 election and the election of President Donald Trump. We've been asking you, are you more or less involved in politics since that day?
Hi, I'm Linda calling from Robbinsville, New Jersey. I've always paid attention to politics, but since last year's presidential election, I've become less a spectator and more of a participant. Through daily calls, through letters, emails, tweets, rallies, marches, and donations, I'm making my voice heard.
1 year after the election of President Donald Trump in 2016, you're telling us how you're engaging with politics. You can always give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can send your tweets to us at The Takeaway. The national debate over who's responsible for immigration enforcement continues, and this week it reached the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans. A three-judge panel in New Orleans sat for arguments yesterday on SB 4 out of Texas. It's a law that effectively bans sanctuary city policies. So SB 4 basically forces close cooperation between local law enforcement and federal immigration authorities. Here's Denise Gilman, director of the Immigration Clinic at Texas Law, explaining how SB 4 works.
On the front end, in terms of allowing police to make immigration inquiries when they are engaged with people in a stop. And then sort of on the back end, it requires compliance with detainer requests that the immigration authorities may put on a local jail, asking the local jail to hold somebody for additional time so that ICE can come and pick them up.
There are sanctuary city cases and challenges in cities and states all over the country, but a ruling here could have a big impact on immigration issues nationwide. I talked to Denise Gilman today, and she broke down some of the legal arguments in the Fifth Circuit surrounding SB 4.
Well, the main issue is that this is the state of Texas dictating to every local jurisdiction in the state the rule of compliance with ICE detainer requests. So it essentially bans any action by local authorities who have decided that they would prefer to limit their entanglement with federal immigration authorities because of local concerns around ensuring community policing possibilities, ensuring public safety by having close collaboration between police and their communities.
So let's go right to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals yesterday, because we have sound from the oral arguments. Arguments began with the state's defense of SB 4. So let's start there. Here's Texas Solicitor General Scott Keller defending SB 4 on several different grounds.
May it please the court. SB 4 is wholly valid. As the state panel correctly concluded, there is no Fourth Amendment violation or federal preemption. And on the facial vagueness and free speech claims, we have offered dictionary definitions of materially limit and endorse, which are reasonable and thus must be accepted. Nor are any of the cross appeal claims successful.
Denise, definitely some legalese there, but Keller is saying several things. He's addressing this argument that SB 4's ability to punish personnel who criticize the law, that that's a violation of the First Amendment, a free speech.
That's what he is referencing when he talks about the idea that they have now offered a limitation on how broadly that law would reach. The MALDEF lawyers, for example, pointed out that the law as written could actually reach, for example, a school administrator who speaks out against the law or any other public official. And so the state of Texas tried to suggest limitations on that, but those limitations really are nowhere in the law. So there's a question about whether the Fifth Circuit will accept this new interpretation that comes so late in the game.
He's also saying there's no federal preemption here. What does he mean?
So what he means by that is that the law around immigration enforcement that is normally federal level doesn't really sort of fully occupy the arena of what can be done in terms of immigration enforcement and allows room for local authorities to engage in especially cooperation with federal immigration authorities, that perhaps local authorities can't go out and independently, completely on their own, engage in immigration enforcement, but that there's still plenty of room for them to collaborate with federal immigration authorities.
Well, let's give a listen to Nina Perales, one of the attorneys arguing against SB 4.
SB 4's enforcement obligations conflict with a federal structure that already controls how and when local actors participate in immigration enforcement. We have an existing federal structure here that's quite comprehensive. Federal law, as the Supreme Court said in Arizona, specifies limited circumstances in which state officers may perform an immigration officer's functions.
Well, she's getting right to the point there, Denise, basically saying that the state of Texas does not have the right to preempt the federal government when it comes to immigration enforcement.
That's right. And she references the Supreme Court's decision on the Arizona SB 1070 law, which really was quite clear in saying that local law enforcement does not have the ability to go out independently and engage in immigration enforcement and must comply with the federal standards around immigration enforcement. And because, as you mentioned, there have been so many cases now litigating the detainer issue, it's pretty clear that the way federal law is constructed is that those detainer requests are interpreted to be voluntary, just requests by the federal government. And so the state of Texas really is on very shaky ground when it then tries to make those requests mandatory. It's really trying to create a new immigration law.
Well, let's hear the argument from the federal government assistant attorney general from the DOJ, Scott Stewart, on this very point.
In Arizona versus United States, the Supreme Court recognized that state officials can cooperate with federal efforts to enforce the immigration laws. SB 4's detainer provision and its enforcement assistance provision both involve the sort of lawful cooperation that the Supreme Court recognized.
Well, there's the Justice Department, Denise, saying that even in Arizona, the Supreme Court said, we can do this.
And the Supreme Court did talk about cooperation, but that really suggests something that is initiated by the federal immigration authorities. And the state of Texas in the arguments acknowledged that that is true, that, for example, a local police officer cannot just independently go out and engage in immigration enforcement. Yet SB 4 prohibits local jurisdictions from telling their officers that they can't go out and engage in immigration enforcement independently. And on the detainer requests, the requests by the federal government's acknowledgement are just voluntary. And so what happens when a local jurisdiction is forced to honor those voluntary requests to hold on to somebody is that they're potentially engaged in Fourth Amendment violations because they're depriving somebody of liberty without any probable cause, without any indication that that individual has to be held in relation with a criminal proceeding, and really with almost nothing in terms of support for the idea that they need to be held in an immigration proceeding.
Just because of the say-so of somebody else in Washington or down at ICE headquarters. Well, Denise, exactly. Where does this case likely go? Is this case headed for the Supreme Court?
It is very likely that the case will head to the Supreme Court. Of course, this hearing yesterday was just on a preliminary matter about whether the law will go into effect while the case is moving forward on the merits. So there is still a long road ahead, but it is very likely that it may go to a full Fifth Circuit hearing en banc and eventually end up at the Supreme Court.
Denise Gilman with the Immigration Clinic at Texas Law in Austin. Thanks, Denise.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Let's turn now to Puerto Rico and a story about one of the most vulnerable populations of Puerto Ricans. The island is home to tens of thousands of veterans. And after Hurricane Maria, Veterans Affairs workers are fighting to get their patients the care they need. Jay Price is a reporter covering the military for WUNC of Chapel Hill in North Carolina, and he has the story.
Every morning now, staff from the main VA hospital in San Juan, like Eduardo Vicente Santini, hit the road. The VA knows that many of its patients have had their lives so thoroughly disrupted that they haven't been able to come in for treatment. So it's checking its records to see which ones haven't been in recently and sending nurses and medical social workers like Vicente Santini out to see them. Today, he's checking on retired U.S. Army Master Sergeant Luciano Sevilla Rivera, who lives alone except for his tiny dog Pepito in a small retirement community in the mountains about an hour southeast of San Juan.
Do you have any relatives that look forward for you?
They are brother and sister.
And they provide you support?
They are in the United States.
The 72-year-old Vietnam veteran recently lost his mother, who was his only relative still in Puerto Rico. And that's one thing Sevilla Rivera wants to explore. He also asks about the veteran's health and how he was affected by the hurricane. The violence of the storm, Sevilla Rivera said, triggered his PTSD.
I just went crazy. I didn't feel good or anything like that, so I stayed in my bed and because I'm here by myself. So. Mm-hmm.
Sevilla Rivera says his car doesn't run and he can't remember how to get to the hospital anymore. For patients who can't get in on their own, the outreach teams offer rides.
If you want to go with us today, you can receive a lotion and medication. What do you think about that?
While some VA staffers make those home visits, others are trying to keep the island's VA clinics running. Some are in temporary facilities because of storm damage.
So this is our waiting area for the patients.
Dr. Louis Gigliotti is director of the VA clinic in the southern city of Ponce. He's leading me on a tour of the tent village that the clinic is housed in.
This area is for check-in.
The clinic's cooling system was damaged during the storm, and in Puerto Rico's humid tropical climate, mold began growing inside almost immediately. Now, the clinic is housed in five tents while the building is being cleaned up. There's also a mobile pharmacy, a clinic and a bus, and a truck in which veterans can get counseling and even help with FEMA applications.
We have been encountering veterans with PTSD.
Dr. Carlos De Jesus is a psychiatrist and heads the behavioral health clinic, which for now he's running out of the bus. He's been seeing patients whose PTSD symptoms have worsened because of the storm. Some have had a common trigger for veterans of many recent wars, the sound of helicopters from the relief efforts. But there are others you might not expect, like the trees that were stripped bare of leaves by the 150-mile-an-hour winds.
Many Vietnam veterans, they seen the lack of leaves in the trees, has flashbacks about the aging orange when they were in Vietnam.
And some see the brown landscape where it used to be green.
It reminds them the sands and the desert in Iraq.
One even said the military-style tents being used for the clinic had startled him because they reminded him of the command centers used by small units in war zones. Some feel like they have to do all they can to control their symptoms because so much is at stake right now.
One of my patients came to see me last week and he was telling me, you know, I feel overwhelmed because my community, they know I'm a veteran. I have become the leader, okay? And, you know, I can't complain about what I'm feeling because, you know, I don't want them to feel that we are falling apart. So but he was falling apart.
Dr. De Jesus said he helped the veteran work through his emotions and vent a little. So for now, he's holding himself together so he can do what a lot of people across Puerto Rico are having to do these days, rebuild.
Jay Price of WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. His story came to us from the American Homefront Project. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. When Tiny Whitefish Energy out of Montana was awarded a $300 million contract to rebuild Puerto Rico's devastated infrastructure after Maria, the public outcry forced the island's power authority, called PREPA, to scrap that deal. Meanwhile, a separate deal worth $200 million went almost unnoticed. PREPA gave a contract to Cobra Acquisitions LLC. They're a tiny subsidiary of Oklahoma-based fossil fuel company Mammoth Energy Services. The deal has brought memories of the Whitefish debacle back for people in Puerto Rico. Kate Aronoff is a writing fellow at In These Times, and she wrote about this deal for The Intercept. Kate, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
What do we know about Cobra and the deal that it got?
So, like you said, Cobra is a really tiny company. It's a wholly owned subsidiary of Mammoth Energy Services, which provides a range of services for fracking companies, for other companies that deal with fossil fuel extraction. So everything from drilling to housing workers on work sites for fracking rigs, for other kinds of extractive services. And Cobra was established earlier this year in April from the merger of two small companies. So they bought both of these companies in total for about $8 million. We only know the name of one of them. That's Higher Power Energy, and that's out of Texas. And they presumably have some experience dealing with investor-owned utilities, but we don't know much about what that experience looks like, and they've been really untransparent about who their leadership is, where they've done this type of work before, and just exactly what all is Cobra Energy.
What is Cobra supposed to do for this $200 million that they're getting?
So they have a contract to repair generation and transmission services. So that means they're not dealing with the sourcing of energy, so they're not, you know, getting power plants back online, but really all of these down power lines that were destroyed and really leveled in Hurricane Maria.
So there's been all this attention to these contracts after Maria, but also about PREPA itself, the Puerto Rican Electrical Power Authority, and its contracting practices. This was the conversation around Whitefish. PREPA did not enter into any mutual aid agreements after Maria. These are typical agreements between utilities. Hey, you have 100 trucks, we have a hurricane, send them over. This did not happen in Puerto Rico. And we've also learned over the last several weeks that PREPA has a long history of unfulfilled contracts and some shady contracts as well. What's going on here?
Right, exactly. This is the thing that's so confusing about both Whitefish and Cobra is that there are these mutual aid agreements, which are the sort of par for the course of how utilities deal with disasters. And they didn't do this. And PREPA has been really untransparent and corrupt for years. And it's important to understand, too, that there's a lot of different layers to this story in that these contracts are taking place in the context of a longstanding push to privatize PREPA. And so you have, on the one hand, people saying, you know, this is evidence that PREPA is totally unqualified to run this utility. It should be taken over entirely, which is a sort of line of the Fiscal Control Board, congressionally appointed body now overseeing Puerto Rico's finances. And on the other hand, you know, you want to maybe have a public utility rather than sort of selling this off to the highest bidder. And so it's this real sort of gray area in terms of, you know, who are the heroes in this fight. I mean, certainly Whitefish seems like a clear sort of foe, a clear bad guy. But yeah, in terms of actually what to look for is sort of hopeful in this. It's really a lot of murky, untransparent work.
What will tell us over the next couple of weeks about whether the Cobra deal, $200 million, is legit?
I think we just have to wait and see. By all accounts, they are, you know, probably more experienced than Whitefish. Whitefish is sort of fantastically terrible. But I think we'll have to see if the results bear out. How is Cobra comparing to other utilities which are coming in now that there are mutual aid agreements in place? And there's also other contracts to pay attention to in terms of rebuilding PREPA. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is handing out contracts. The Department of Energy is handing out contracts. So I think those are worth paying attention to as well, and not just the ones that PREPA has entered into directly.
Kate Aronoff with The Intercept, writing about Cobra Energy in Puerto Rico. Kate, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, Babbel.com.
Solar energy is getting cheaper, a lot cheaper, and that means that the technology is starting to spread not just to suburban homes with roofs that face south, but also to small communities around the world where traditional power grids don't even reach. In a lot of ways, this is the dream that renewable energy advocates have had for years, only the solar power that they wanted was too expensive to ever be taken seriously. Still, solar energy makes up only a tiny fraction of the world's energy supply right now. Our partner Retro Report, in collaboration with Quartz, has been looking at the future now that solar appears to have crossed a critical price point. Their latest documentary in the What Happens Next series is called The Future of Home. Lonnie Groffman is an author and engineering lecturer at Humboldt State University. He's featured in the new documentary, and he says that solar has now become the cheapest way of producing energy.
There's all types of other reasons for solar to be taking such a big foothold now. But a lot of those reasons have been present for the whole time of solar. You know, climate change and energy independence have always been issues. But the fact that solar has just dropped so precipitously in price is why it's taking over now.
Well, let's hear a little bit from the film. This is Amy Strutz. She's owner of AJ Leo Electric and Solar in Michigan. One of the people who's been installing lots of solar panels on the homes of people in Ypsilanti and other towns, incentivized by tax cuts from the local and state government. Listen.
Most of the people that I deal with, it's a financial decision. Some people it's a green decision, and some people it's a combination.
All right, so she's saying there, Lonnie, yeah, some people are into the green movement, but a lot of people are just saving money, and that's the bottom line.
And when I first started teaching renewable energy almost 15 years ago, solar cost more than $8 per power unit, right? And now it's less than a dollar. You know, there's very few things that we've seen take an entire order of magnitude drop. You know, because we finally have invested the amount of money you need to invest in a new technology, we're finally getting to those price savings. And it's just going to continue. You know, solar will always get more and more affordable, and the sun will always be relatively free.
So, Lonnie, what's the real promise of solar here in the real world? I mean, where is it going to be most useful in the next 10 years? I don't think that the skyscrapers of New York City are going to all go solar and that's going to replace Con Edison in New York. Probably not. But there might be other places where it's more practical.
I think it's practical everywhere. I think that the image of having the solar panel directly on the building with which it's serving, that might not be the view of the city of the future. But those same buildings being powered by solar and other renewables, solar concentrated collectors, wind, I think you will see that. I think we need to see it, in fact. And then there's other places where that solar impact is even more obvious, in places that did not have grid electricity and may never have grid electricity, where a solar panel can completely transform the life of a family or a village, or especially a rural environment where normally the children have to go to the city to find jobs. Now they're able to get education and access to resources. When you combine distributed solar with distributed internet and distributed safe water and distributed financial instruments, you can create situations where rural environments have the opportunities that used to be just present in the urban environment.
So talk a little bit more, though, about how solar power is distributed. One of the points that's made here is that it's not just that it's renewable from the sun, but that it can be broken up, distributed house by house, village by village. You don't need to be wired to the big utility. Why does that matter?
Grid-connected solar, industrial solar, residential solar, rural solar, and distributed solar, investments in any support all of them. And so you're building this ecosystem of renewable energy, which allows people to own how they want their energy to be produced. And by distributing it, you make it so that communities that might have been overlooked or that have traditionally been overlooked, they can just literally take the power for themselves.
Lonnie, there does seem to be a great promise of democratization of power generation here that you're describing. But look, this was the same promise with the internet when it was brand new. It was going to democratize information. It turns out that a few giant corporations now control a lot of the information, and we're right back in a monopolistic type of scenario that we were in before the internet existed. And I wonder if that's a danger with solar power here. Yes, people can buy it. They can make some choices. But eventually, just a couple of big companies are going to control the means of producing this power and distributing it.
So one of the great parts of renewable energy is that there's so many different ways to do it. And the more we invest in any of the ways, it helps the other ways. And so between solar and wind and biogas and all the different ways that a community can take ownership of their own power, I don't think that we have that same worry.
And the fossil fuel companies, we don't need to tell each other, have enormous power in the marketplace and in politics. You've been at this for decades. Are you ready to say today that you finally have them beat?
Yes. But also, I'm an optimist, and I think I've been saying that for 15 years. you know, you have a situation now with, for instance, the Paris Accord, where every nation in the world but one is signing on to that Paris Agreement. I think that one nation, you know, ours, the United States, is showing the massive drive towards renewables. Community by community and state by state, you look and you see that we're doubling down in most cases on our renewable energy.
Lonnie Grofman, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Todd.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Details are slowly emerging around the motivations of Devin Patrick Kelly when he opened fire on the First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs in Texas on Sunday. The church's pastor and his wife were out of town when that shooting occurred. Their 14-year-old daughter, Annabelle, was not. She did not survive.
Our church was not comprised of members or parishioners. We were a very close family. We ate together. We laughed together. We cried together. And we worship together. Now most of our church family is gone. Our building is probably beyond repair. And the few of us that are left behind lost tragically yesterday.
That's Sherry Pomeroy, Annabelle's mother and wife of Pastor Frank Pomeroy. To Pardeep Kalika, Sherry Pomeroy's grief is all too familiar. In 2012, a man opened fire inside Pardeep's Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Pardeep's father was temple president, Satwan Singh Kalika. He was shot and killed that day, along with five other people. Pardeep joined us back in August on the anniversary of that attack. So what does a community do when the congregants are gone, the place of worship is destroyed, stained by the deaths of the people who were there? Pardeep Kalika is with us again today. Pardeep, thanks for coming back to speak with me.
Thank you for having me.
Pardeep, as the magnitude of this attack in Texas became apparent, I can't imagine the rush of feelings and grief that must have flooded back to you.
You said it right on. It's like a flood of feelings that come back. And I find myself sort of like if I was a child and being bullied and I grow older and, you know, you try to forget all those things, but then all of a sudden something triggers you and you're back to that child state again. Every time one of these things happens, I'm back to that mode of like, okay, I'm going through the same grieving process. I'm in shock and kind of in denial that this happened to our community. Obviously angry all at the same time. So, you know, that Sunday becomes almost, I don't know what to do. I'm sitting there with my children and I'm supposed to have a day off. And it just becomes a wasted day of just ruminating on thoughts.
Well, if we can go back to that experience a little bit, Pardeep, after the attack on August 5th in 2012, what was the state of the Oak Creek Temple after all the investigators had gone away and you and the community were left not only with your grief, but a wrecked place of worship? What was it like?
Difficult. You had a community that was torn apart. We talk about the external wounds, obviously. The external wounds being that, you know, six people are dead. The shooter is dead. There's other people who are suffering wounds. So there is the definite horrors that are occurring externally, but there's also the internal wounds. The internal wounds being that you have a community that is completely disheveled and lost of leadership, and the glue that's holding, and then this is for Texas as well, that community is being held together by this faith and the sacredness of the space. And now the question becomes internally, where was God? where was God that day? And did these people deserve to die? Is there some kind of like destiny?
You talk about that question, where was God? Oak Creek is a faithful, a religious community. Sutherland Springs certainly is a faithful community. And it's one thing that faith helps get you through, but there must be a struggle about how this could have happened in the first place. I mean, you said the question becomes, where was God to prevent this?
And for luckily for us at Six, we believe that God is an omnipresent force that exists not only externally, but inside every person, inside of everything. So we believe it to be the energy source, our soul. And even in the shooters, we can see that somewhere God exists there. But I think that this community is going to really have to struggle with that and say, this is a place of worship. This is a place of prayer. How can I bring back the sacredness of the space?
There's the physical damage to bodies, Pardeep. There's the spiritual damage to the psyche and the soul. What about the damage to the temple itself? What was your place of worship like when it was all done? And how did the community even go about beginning to clean it up?
So the investigation lasted a few days, which allowed for investigators and then people to come in there and clean it up. They had cleaned it up before. Most of the victims had stepped foot back into that place because they figured that it would be so re-traumatizing for us to see the blood on the floors, the carpets were soaked, the walls, the drywall, bullet holes all over the place. So really cleaning it up from a visual standpoint. But like I said, there's those internal wounds that you know what happened here. And that's tough to clean up. That's something that they have to go through their own grieving process and really allow the shock, the denial, the anger, the sadness, the acceptance to really run its course and say, okay, now we can't deny this. We have to understand that it happened here. How do we heal? And that was the most difficult part. Personally speaking, for our community, it was trying to put on a brave face for the world. So we thought that we had a responsibility to the world. And that was for the first year. Once the first year marker came and we commemorated the first year anniversary by having communal prayer, after that, things got real. And once things get real and then the cameras go in, everything goes away, you're kind of left there to deal with your own personal process.
Do you know people in the community who just have not been able to go back into the Oak Creek Temple since?
Most people, because it is the one of the only Sikh gurdwaras in the area, most people have gone back into that because they really have no option of going somewhere else. It's such a small, tight-knit community that's kind of our only option. But I do know people, and this is a majority of people, would not go back as often, are more cautious about going back, are kind of looking over their shoulder or developing emergency plans, which is fine. But now we're struggling with communities who are basically faith-based. And that's a dichotomy of like, how much faith do you have to go into this place rather than how much are you trying to protect yourself because you're so fearful?
So Pardeep, you're in the unfortunate position of being able to give advice or at least the value of your own experience with a tragedy like this to people in Sutherland Springs and other places as well. It's early days. This attack has only just happened this week. The cameras probably aren't gone yet. The investigators aren't gone yet. That's all still to come, as you mentioned. What are the conversations right now that you think are going on between people in that tiny town that the rest of us couldn't even imagine?
Yeah, the conversations probably right now that are happening with that community are, how do we secure this to come back to that church? You know, and they're not to be judged for this, but the response will probably be that we need to have armed guards and we need to have people protecting that sacred space. So that's the immediate response, which is fine. That's what they have to do to kind of move on. And you're right, the cameras are probably not gone. They're probably there, and some of the community has not slept. So they're just kind of going on adrenaline. There's going to be money that's going to be coming in. I'm sure there's donation sites. They need to, somebody in that town needs to make sure that those donations get to the right people. They get to the victims' families, because it's going to be tough for a family who's lost 4 people, 5 people, you know, anybody, to go back to work and say, okay, well, now I'm just going to go back to work next week. give them a little bit of time to kind of have some solace and have some money in the bank account to kind of move forward.
Pardeep Kalika is part of the Sikh community in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Pardeep, thank you so much for being with us again today.
Thank you. God bless.
And we leave you today with some sad news for baseball fans. Two-time Cy Young Award-winning pitcher and likely future Hall of Famer Roy Halladay died in a plane crash off the Gulf of Mexico yesterday. He was 40 years old. Halladay spent his big league career on the mound for the Toronto Blue Jays and the Philadelphia Phillies, always ahead in the count. You can reach us at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for being with us today. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.